The following is intended only for mature audiences. Discretion advised.
Okay, so tonight we'll be talking about Spawn 21.
Released on May the 30th, 1994, which was 3.5 months after issue number 18 and 3.5 months before issue number 19. This is 21 now. I'm pretty sure that's the longest publishing gap in Spawn's history. It's also the first issue by Todd McFarlane after 6.5 months, signaling the beginning of the end run for his drawing the book. Since Greg Capullo-drawn issues were released intermittently with the McFarlane ones, it had the unintended effect of diluting the point of his actually taking over permanent art duties with issue 26, I believe. Capullo was just kind of always there, going back to issue number 16. Spawn number 21 came out the same month as Images of Tomorrow, where a bunch of second-tier books pretended that they had gotten 25 issues out around the same time Spawn nearly had.
Yeah. I remember going to a shop and people being pissed off, like they felt like they were missing issues or something.
Yeah, they should read their solicitations. Because of delays, both Supreme number 12 and number 25 came out the same month. Also, Violator number 1 was released, so there's another series we'll have to address pretty soon. This issue is The Hunt Part 1. It features inks by Mark Pennington, along with the usual top flight support of Tom Orzechowski and Steve Olaf. The issue is dedicated to Mike Grell, one of the first name artists to strike out on his own with a successful creator-owned series. He had contributed a pinup titled Leatherstocking to Spawn number 2, and his image series Shyamalan's Tears had begun. It was on a lengthy hiatus, and I think it was officially canceled sometime around here, so maybe the dedication was some kind of mea culpa.
Well, we start the issue with Spawn bitching and complaining because his face is being sewn up
by Bobby, his buddy, in the homeless community.
Now, this took place after the Batman, right?
Here's the interesting thing.
I was going to ask you that. If this takes place after the Batman, does that mean Batman is part of his continuity now?
Here's the thing about that. Todd McFarlane explicitly stated in interviews that Spawn Batman was not in continuity, that both of the books were going to be out of their respective characters' continuities. Obviously, the Image book was from more the McFarlane perspective, and the DC book was more from their perspective, but they were not in continuity, either one of them. Plus, the Tom Orzechowski Houdini story makes it clear that Spawn gets shot in the face while protecting Terry from gunfire. And so that establishes how his face got ripped in half, you know, and why he was getting sewn up by Bobby. However, it's also abundantly clear that the final splash page in the Spawn Batman book is essentially redrawn for the first splash page in the Spawn issue that follows it. In one version, he's smiling with the batarang in his face. In the other version, he's scowling with the shoelaces being sewn up to bring his face back together. And he says that it had happened because of Bozo in Black.
Okay.
So it's very clear that he's intentionally being ambiguous, but I strongly favor the Spawn Batman thing being in continuity. I think that was his sly way of bringing Spawn Batman into continuity.
So then that means that's DC's New York that he lives in.
No, actually, I think that's the Image version of Batman. And another thing that we talked about, and we talked about it a bit in the episode, but I wanted to reinforce it. It's clear that Batman exists in the Spawn universe. He is a known figure, but apparently he's another one of those urban legends where people are aware that there's a Batman out there, but people don't actually believe that Batman was in New York fighting Spawn. But he does exist. Just like in the DC book, it's very clear that nobody knows who the fuck Spawn is. Spawn doesn't know who the fuck Batman is, and that's much more in isolation. But Spawn Batman clearly takes place in a continuity where people know who Batman is. So the way I like to see it is because so few of the Image books were set in New York, on purpose, I believe, because they knew that Marvel so owned New York and so much of their stuff was related to New York that they wanted to be someplace else. They wanted to have a different vibe and have their own cities. So I firmly believe that Image Comics exists in a continuity where the DC and Marvel universes exist, and they just don't relate to each other very often. But especially in the 90s, there were a lot of crossovers between Image and Marvel and Image and DC. Mm-hmm. More Image and Marvel. So there's no reason to think that there isn't a DC and Marvel versions of in Image. You know, I think that those universes exist within the Image Comics universe. I don't think it's a two-way street, though. I don't believe that the Image characters exist at Marvel or at DC. So it's sort of like, I think Image Comics is sort of like a focal point of the multiverse,
okay,
where Marvel and DC drain into them via, say, the Bleed, for instance, but they don't bleed back into those other universes.
So then who's on first?
Carry on with the synopsis.
Okay. You missed my joke.
No, I got the joke. It's just, I guess I was a little confusing.
Well, no, how it works. The continuity makes sense because I did read a bunch of those books where, like, it just seems weird to me because that means if Batman does exist in Spawn's world, but he doesn't exist because he's an urban legend.
Well, no. It's just the same shit that's at DC.
But what about
you know
Soup?
You know what,
and Wonder Woman?
I think they all exist within Image, yes. I think what it is, those guys all live in Metropolis and Gotham and New York, and they're just in a whole other city. So maybe the Image guys are off in the periphery somewhere, and they're not affecting anything that's going on in those respective universes.
So it's
but
not
the
like
stuff that happens there, it actually makes sense because if you think about it, Image was clearly and intentionally derivative of the big comic book universes. We know this. This isn't a surprise, right? So it makes more sense for Image to exist in a place where Marvel and DC also exist.
Yes.
And if you think about it, like, there's very few instances of big crossovers at Image.
Yeah.
More so in the early days, but basically what happens, this goes back to Liefeld. I think that Liefeld kind of ruined that because when he left Image or was kicked out of Image, depending on whose perspective you take on that, and Wright started to get sticky because all these guys did were handshake deals. They weren't putting any contracts down, which of course fucked them royally, Todd McFarlane especially. But there's all these weird rights issues with a lot of that early Image stuff that nobody seems to want to talk about. But it's clear that that's the case because they didn't sign fucking contracts. I once tried to tweet at Rob Liefeld asking him how Hellspawn can be at DC when Hellspawn is an Acuron, which is a alien race that Rob Liefeld is supposed to own, except something we'll talk about later on, Liefeld doesn't own them anymore. So that's a whole other fucking thing. They never got the contracts right to make sure it's okay to do these crossovers for the most part. I think maybe Kirkman's an exception because he's a guy who seems like he does crossovers. Also, I think he just wants to do crossovers. I think he still has that, or at least he had until perhaps recent years, a genuine love of comics and a willingness to find a way to make sure the Image characters would appear in his books. But I also think that he's legally savvy enough to where he doesn't fuck himself while he's doing it. The early Image creators did fuck themselves by thinking that they were cooler with each other than they were.
Yeah.
And so you don't really see Image comic crossovers that much. There were just a handful of them where the entire company was involved with them, right? And so my thinking is that it makes sense. Superman and Batman and Wonder Woman and Spider-Man and Captain America and the Avengers, those guys are the ones taking care of the big universe stuff. And the Image guys are just, I'm in New York, I'm in LA, I'm in Washington, D.C., wherever the hell they are, they're local. It enforces the Image characters as being kind of smaller scale. But they are, because they don't do the big universal crossovers because of rights issues. It's a major factor with that. So they're just not involved. They're not big enough to warrant being in the Justice League, for instance.
Okay, so...
And anyway, and what else also reinforces that, too, is the fact that DC bought Wildstorm, and yet most of the Wildstorm characters don't have a major presence at DC Comic, because they're not to the scale to runner with the DC characters. It's kind of like with Secret Wars and Daredevil. Daredevil, really popular character. People wanted to see him in Secret Wars, but let's be honest, Daredevil doesn't belong there. He's not that kind of character. And when they try to smoosh him into Secret Wars 2, it just didn't work that great. He doesn't fit in those type of stories. And I think maybe Image is kind of like that in the relationship with Marvel and DC.
Okay, so you're saying that DC purchased Image?
No, Wildstorm.
Well, Wildstorm.
But... Which is, I mean, it's not exactly a spoiler for future episodes or anything, but I don't want to dwell on that too much.
Okay. Well, no, we'll get to that then. It just seems really strange, but okay.
Well, you knew that though.
Yeah, well, yeah, because I mean, when you got fucking Martian Manhunter showing up in fucking Stormwatch and shit, which was really weird to me.
I'm one of the few people, I loved that, and I wanted to see more done with that, and it never came up to anything. It's actually, I think it's literally not even in their continuity anymore. They've so completely obliterated that element of the history.
Really? So I haven't really picked up anything in DC for a while, so I don't know.
Yeah.
All right. So he alludes that a dude in dark who apparently just smiled at him and you could only make out his eyes did this to him.
And again, very canny because are they talking about Houdini or are they talking about Batman?
Oh, that's true. Nah, it's definitely Batman.
It's definitely Batman.
Yeah,
it's definitely Batman. Yeah.
He hit him with a Batarang.
Plausible
face.
Deniability, which obviously pays off because this is the one instance where Todd didn't get sued for something.
Oh, shit. Bobby's telling him, you know, how they depend on Spawn. Spawn's kind of doing a little pity party for himself and he's telling him how.
Wait, I only came back from my wife and I can't have my wife and this sucks.
Like, everything bad is happening, man. Like, it's
nothing
like,
good comes out of here.
Yeah. So he's like, so Bobby tells him a story about how, you know, he was in love with a woman who met at church who basically was his world. She dies of cancer, brain cancer. He doesn't handle it well. His life goes to shit. And so Spawn, in the rare moments, actually says, well, I'm sorry to hear that. And he's like, I'm not trying to get you to pity me. I'm just saying, I didn't handle this well. You need to, because we depend on you.
And we look up to you.
We look up to you.
We like you and you want, we need you.
Yeah, he's basically their protector.
Which is weird because I think that the perspective I come at it from is that the homeless guys, the guys in the alley, I thought their world went to shit when Spawn showed up because they kept getting killed. But like, for instance, the cop chase in that one issue where the cops run over a homeless dude and they don't even take note of it. Possibly this was happening all the time. And possibly what's happening is Spawn has scared enough people away from his alleys that 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 shit doesn't happen anymore. So maybe those guys were treated as disposable by more than just cyborgs from the mafia.
That's true.
And so maybe in the grand scheme of things, Spawn is actually helping them. We just haven't seen that perspective much because we're working on the assumption that all this incredible lethal shit happened after Spawn showed up.
So, I was going to ask you this, man. Do you think Todd McFarlane had based his clown off of It?
I spent so many years just thinking, God, fucking Joker. Why the hell would you take your Batman-ish character and have him up against a Joker-ish character? But when you think about it, especially he has that New York accent, mm-hmm. and he's
big giant row of teeth.
Yeah. It turns into a big... Yeah. That's a very sound observation, sir.
Okay.
And I don't think I've ever made that connection. I think it's very insightful.
Oh, wow. I franked you. So this is what it feels like. Hold on. I want to feel it for a moment. Nice. I think Mac would enjoy it.
We're proud of you.
Yeah. One other reason I bring it up is because I was rewatching the series because of the movies coming out, and there's that scene where Pennywise opens his mouth, and I was like, you know what? This feels very fucking Violator. You know?
Yeah, it's just that there are two distinct entities where often Pennywise will show those sides of his monstrous self while still in the clown guise. Yeah. But in the case of Violator, we don't know that he's a demon.
Yeah, you do. If you read the It books, you do.
Oh, so I thought there were some inference that he might actually be an alien. Wasn't he a comet that falls from the skies?
One man's demon is another man's alien, dude. Let's be honest, man. Okay. The counterbalance to Pennywise is some turtle in the galaxy that spits up universes. This is Stephen King's work. So that'll be the new podcast.
Spoilers, there's no turtle in the remake, by the way.
That's the Stephen King podcast we'll come up with down the line. But I was just making that observation. I was like, man, it just seemed very, I don't know.
There's a lot of Tim Curry-esque stuff to Violator. That makes sense.
So now, I no longer hear the cartoon, or I don't hear the actor John Leguizamo. I hear Pennywise from It. When I'm reading the Violator, I kind of hear that. Because I'm actually reading the Violator series. I'm just trying to get ahead of us.
Oh, good. Yeah. Excellent. I need to read that then. I'll catch up with you.
So I was reading it. It just happened.
Well, actually, this will probably be the Violator episode. So.
Was it? Okay, good. Then I'm ahead. So anyway, back to the issue. Sorry. Wynn is no longer the fucking guardian or whatever the fuck he was. Anti-Spawn?
That is not stated in this book. That when we last saw Jason Wynn,
he was blasted
Only was he still the vessel for the anti-Spawn, but they were actually putting more power into him. So the fact that he shows up after just being missing for 2 days and is not exhibiting any superpowers is very curious.
Remembrance of any of this?
Yeah. That's less so. I could buy him, although I'm not sure. He says it's amnesia, and it may very well be, but given that it's Jason Wynn, I don't think we can rely on that being the truth.
Okay. So Jason Wynn is pissed because he still wants Terry to be followed because they still...
Well, they've done a report and they've determined that Terry Fitzgerald is definitely not the leak.
Yeah.
However, Wynn is already in a position of weakness and does not want to seem any more vulnerable than he already is. So he insists on the report that clears Terry to be burned and for everything to continue. And for the guy who gave him the report initially, never question my orders again or I'll fucking have you killed. He literally says
But he has a fucking hard on for Terry. Big time.
Yeah. And is there a rationale for that in the comic book?
I don't know. That's why when I was reading this, I'm like, everything we've read up to this point, except for training.
I don't think
he never really had that much hands on with Terry. It was more Al, him and Al, you know, Al. Then he trained Al and kind of.
When? Yeah, definitely.
He shaped his career. Terry was more like the buddy that Al.
Like another work buddy.
Yeah.
Like from another department that Wynn didn't have anything to do with.
Yeah, communications or some shit like that. So it felt really
I'm wondering if maybe there's two things. One is it might just be that he's trying to mask his weakness, which is what he explicitly says in the book. But also the fact that he makes a point of having Wanda become tailed as well.
Yeah.
Makes me wonder if the anti-Spawn isn't working through him to continue putting pressure on somebody he knows is thought to spawn.
So the anti-Spawn might reappear. Maybe like are we doing a Fight Club here now?
Well, I mean, is a distinct entity. So it's not a multiple personality thing. There's a distinct entity within him.
Well, okay,
so it's more like the Spectre, as you were referencing, I think, in a previous episode.
So I thought maybe like the anti-Spawn was like nudging him mentally.
It could be potentially
kinda
nudging
like
him.
A Tyler Durden thing where
Jason
Wynn wakes up and he's like, I wake up in a different city every week. And there's a new anti-Spawn sighting when I pass out. I don't know.
It's just not the direct connection I would make just because the multiple personality is such a big part of that.
Okay.
Spoilers from Fight Club. Too bad. Should have watched it 20 years ago.
Yeah. Welcome to today, man. Tyler would be upset. So they're doing the...
Woody? Huh? Woody, really? I don't think so.
Yeah, he would. His revolution didn't come to flourish like he wanted to. This issue was kind of weird, man. Because he wants
it's another
followed. He's not
fucking...
being followed.
Yeah.
He wants Wanda followed. She's going to be followed. Then we immediately go to Sam and Twitch, who are beating the shit out of a suspect.
They found a pound and a half of crack in his car.
Yeah,
so
right.
They're torturing the guy. Police brutality is even mentioned.
Which really weird for Twitch, because Twitch is usually the straight and narrow guy.
But he's being sarcastic about brutalizing this dude for information.
Yeah.
Which is, again, very much a trope in the 90s and earlier.
I'm getting doesn't play
well today, though.
Yeah.
With what we know today, does not play well. I'm not fans of these guys.
Yeah.
Even with the dude who has a pound and a half of crack in his car, they do make a point of saying, oh, you're selling it to school children. We've had the discussions about whether or not that was really that big of a thing. I don't know. It left a real bad taste in my mouth.
It just was kind of weird.
But they're continuing to pursue Spawn. A mob enforcer is in the alleys beating people up, trying to, again, find Spawn, gets his ass kicked by Spawn, goes back to Tony Twistelli, Antonio Twistelli. They really make a point of emphasizing that he's not Tony Twist. Definitely not Tony Twist.
That cost
these are reprints that we were reading. Anyway, you read a reprint too, didn't you?
Yes.
And apparently it's a trap that Tony is laying down. Antonio, Dracula, is laying down. They're laying out a trap for Spawn because apparently Antonio also looked very weak when Spawn came after him. Mm-hmm. And he has to do a show of force so the other mobsters don't think that he's vulnerable. So he's apparently, based on what he's saying, in the exact same position as when he's being a dick to make sure that people don't think that he's weak.
Okay. And then that was it, wasn't it?
They just had that page of the talking heads going on and on and on about all this stuff that you would never get on TV, like the detailed medical history of when after he was found and all this bullshit. But yeah, they're basically going into heavy duty recap mode, which how many times have we done this in the Spawn comic at this point where they devote an entire issue to catching us up on a book that doesn't have much momentum and isn't that fucking complicated?
I feel this is just him saving on having to write any issues.
I honestly don't know if he knows where to go yet, still 2 fucking years into this thing, and we're still fucking reciting the same basic fucking information. Get on with it. Jesus.
Okay. And sorry. That was 21.
I will say this though, I did like the art in the issue.
Wanda looked kind of weird.
It's not an omnibus, but it's like something like 12 plus issues.
Yeah.
And the coloring on that paper was really dark, and so it looked a little weird. All the African American characters in that particular issue looked weird because the coloring was so dark. And yeah, she is running around with like her navel exposing top and stuff.
You don't cheesecake-y. Look like a mom. Definitely Mary J. Watson choice.
It's kind of one of her get-ups, but also I don't know if you would wear that hanging around the house, which is what she seemed to be doing. But I feel like because of all that extra detail, he was putting a lot of extra detailing. It seemed like there's a lot more.
I don't know. Her hair looked weird. It just looked weird.
Well, it's funny because you were complaining about the lack of detail in Spawn Batman.
Yeah.
And then here it's like he's going out of his way to draw everything extra rendered. I mean, Bobby has so many fucking lines on him. He looks cool. The issue in general, I think, looks really cool. But I almost feel like this is the final 4 issues that are going to be drawn by Todd McFarlane. His final 4-issue arc as the sole major creative force on the book. And I almost feel like he was going a little extra mile just because he knew that he was wrapping it up, essentially. So I'm curious to see if maybe the reason why we're getting this dense recap is to get everybody on the same page so he can maybe actually tell a complete 4-issue story and give us some sort of a resolution. I'm hopeful of that, but obviously my hopes for Spawn are almost constantly dashed, so we'll see how it goes.
But I just
want to give credit to him. I could see the extra effort he was putting in this issue, and it was appreciated.
Well, let's be honest. It definitely was going to sell some more toys, too. It was a new Spawn figure with a slash and shoelaces in his face.
I'm sure they didn't hurt, but he didn't have to put extra effort into the issue just for that. I did notice, too, that Bobby calls him Hamburger Head, and that was the unofficial name of that version of Spawn for a number of years. They actually produced an action figure under the name Hamburger Head, and I tend to, when I'm referring to this period, that's what I say. So I think this is the first time we've seen in print that term being used.
Okay.
Hi, heroes. I'm Stan Lee, but hold the applause. Listen, we have a real treat for you this time. I've got Rob Liefeld, and I don't seem to recall your name. Todd McFarlane, yes, we've met before.
Yes, sir.
Two of the best artists, writers in this business. And we have the rare opportunity of having them together, and we're going to do something that's never been done before. I'm going to throw a name at them, and they're going to create a character based on what I tell them, and you better make it good.
Now we're going to vamp a little bit. How much of that Rob Liefeld interview did you get read?
Just a little bit, not much. I'm reading so many different things right now.
Can you tell me a little bit about what you read and why you had some issues with them?
Well, I haven't read the interview. I haven't touched yet. I've read all the other stuff, like some of the other stuff early.
Well, what did you read? Tell me what you were telling me that you'd done some reading of interviews about Liefeld.
Well, no,
and you found him to be a little bit shady, and I was curious.
Well, no, he was just kind of attacking
Marvel. Or throwing shade.
Yeah, he was attacking Marvel. Not without being able to reference the book I was reading, man. Hold on. Even people who absolutely hate our books acknowledge that the coloring is superior to most of the books out there.
So we had to stop Spawnometer pretty much dead in its tracks because we have to parallel where Spawn's going to go in the coming months. And unfortunately, that created a production delay. Even though we've had multiple episodes recorded in the can with the intention of releasing them, we couldn't because it doesn't match up with Spawn. So we're going to go ahead and do an episode that spotlights Youngblood and And we need to tell folks how Overkill comes back into the story.
Frank tortured me with Youngblood, Strike File number 4.
Dead Set on Destruction by creator story Rob Liefeld, pencils by Jeff Matsuda. I think one of the first things he ever did. Inks by Danny Meekie with a script. You know, they put that guy, poor guy, way down at the bottom. And editor, Eric Stevenson. Because if there's anybody that Image guys have contempt for, it's writers and editors. And Eric Stevenson fit both those categories.
It's a Youngblood comic, very much so, into a federal research facility in the Pentagon area where apparently they're rebuilding Overt Kill. He's not Overkill, right? It's Overt Kill?
Yeah, I think he was only ever Overkill in the Staber video. I think in order to trademark him, they had to turn it into Overt Kill.
Yeah, because I saw that on YouTube that you're telling me where him and Rob Liefeld, they get together and they're all creating a character in like 20 minutes or less.
Yeah, Todd McFarlane and Stan Lee.
So they're showing how he's being, I guess, reassembled after his defeat by Spawn.
I mean, he looked like he was pretty much dead, so they didn't have a lot to work with. You'd think they'd just start over from scratch with what little Spawn had left after issue 7.
Or they're talking about how they're trying to reincorporate him into the military complex, which I'm assuming built him in the beginning, but they didn't really explain how they lost him, did they? Or did I lose that in the reading?
Basically, there's two brothers that are both like hardcore scientist guys, and one of the brothers works for this Pentagon operation, and he created Overkill, a sort of a prototype cyborg, and after like a mission or two, he went rogue or disappeared, and I think he just disappeared because they didn't know what had happened to him, and of course, he ends up working for the Mafia, so it's a pretty safe assumption that he went rogue, but the government doesn't necessarily know that, and so they find what's left of him, and so the other scientist brother works for the Mafia, and he probably had a lot to do with that whole rogue thing happening.
Youngblood, especially Shaft, seems to have a reservation about him being rebuilt, and I guess even Badrock at one point says that he looked bigger than the first time they met up.
Allusions to a point in which Overkill had fought Youngblood or had maybe worked with Youngblood, and I don't know if we ever got that story.
No, I don't remember ever reading that. That's why when I was reading
it, I mean, I don't think it ever happened. I mean, I know it hadn't happened up to this point because that's one of the things that Image did is they started in media res. They started as if the entire universe had already been around for years and years, and you were just expected to catch up. So they were always alluding to stuff that was supposed to have happened in the past, and some of that stuff would get filled in. I think Wildstorm was pretty good about filling in some of those gaps, where Liefeld stuff, not so much. They were constantly alluding to stuff that you didn't necessarily ever get to see. So as much as I'd like to see the
basically
first...
Basically stuff off panel that happened.
Yeah, yeah, and stuff happening before those early issues. The doctor who's working for the Pentagon is named Peterson, and I'll read the dialogue right quick. Overkill was one of my greatest creations, as well as being one of my most dramatic failures. No one was more disheartened than I when we learned he was destroyed on only his second mission, and no one was more appalled when Overkill reappeared several months later, rebuilt and reprogrammed by the Sicilian mob boss Luigi Bartino. Believe me, Shaft, nobody wants to see Overkill under our control again more than me.
I don't know, it just seems really weird. Like, it makes no sense.
I mean, I don't have a problem with it. They're just establishing that the universe has been around for a while, that Overkill has ties to Youngblood, because...
But understand, didn't in the Spawn comics, didn't they talk about all these kills he committed? Like, he had a high kill rate?
Yeah, I assume after he became a Mafia enforcer. Yeah, I'm assuming
yeah.
so.
Yeah. Did we ever find out who Overkill was originally?
I'm not sure. I mean, he's going to make a lot of appearances. And because it's a character that's shared by Liefeld and McFarlane, I assume that Liefeld wanted to make it clear that it was his character too, and give him ties to his universe rather than it just being,
I got you,
some flunky.
Not just a Spawn.
Yeah.
Got you. Okay, so I guess Overkill can be our connecting tissue between the Spawn universe and the Youngblood universe.
Well, and it's funny because at the time I didn't really care that much about that being the case because there was a lot of crossovers with the Image characters. But after there was acrimony that set in fairly quickly within the first few years of Image, and those crossovers became fewer and farther between. And so now it makes Overkill like a fairly rare connective character that really has a lot of travel within the Image universe, the Image sphere.
Yeah.
I value him more now than I did then because at the time I thought he was sort of like a cross between Juggernaut and every lame-o robot that gets blasted to pieces just because you can blast a robot to pieces.
Yeah, and then you bring him back. You just put him back together afterwards. Shaft and them are not happy about them rebuilding Overt Kill. At this time, Antonio Twist is being pressured by the mob bosses to bring back Overt Kill because they're upset because he was on loan and nothing more. And Twist is upset that he needs to get a hold of Overt Kill, but his henchmen are...
They're not going to break into the Pentagon, you know?
Yeah, they can't break... You know, he's not even scared to go up against the government, but they can't find him. And even apparently there was a tracking device inside Overkill that whenever they took the part, the pieces that I guess was lost or never activated.
Yeah. Think that the two Peterson scientist brothers must have had something to do with creating Overkill. And Wendell's the one who works for the government. Kendall's the one who works for the mafia. And Kendall had this the back door basically as a way to take control.
Oh, okay.
And I think what they're trying to say is that they just let the government rebuild Overkill so it wouldn't come out of Tony Twist's pocket. Scientist guy's basically like, great, my brother's going to rebuild him, and then I'm just going to take him back over again.
Okay, so they're twins, the twin brothers.
Something. I don't know if they're twins. They don't really look alike. I think that Corrupt One is an older brother.
Oh, okay.
He's all balding with, like, he looks like Lemony Snicket or something. Not Lemony Snicket. Who's the guy from Count Orloff?
Yeah, Lemony Snickers or
whatever the fuck. Snickets, yeah. Or... where the other brother just looks like, well, I mean, he's got white hair too, so I guess either one of them, but he's got more of like kind of a, not flock of seagulls, but definitely kind of a new wave hair.
Yeah, no, I'm really looking at the pages here. You're right. They look nothing. I assumed. So I guess they reactivate Overkill from a distance?
Your remote control. I don't think it's remote control. Yeah. I think it's more of a remote activation that allows him to operate himself. I think they're disabling whatever the government was using to subdue him.
And so Overkill's getting back to what he does, and he starts trying to escape, and he's killing everybody. I don't remember the chains.
That's the chains are in the video.
Really?
Yeah, no, I think that was literally Todd McFarlane's main contribution to the creation of Overkill was, give him a lot of chains. Chains are cool. Kids dig chains.
He does look smaller than the other version, I guess. I don't know. And they show Bad Rock, and I guess we get more insight into his young life because he has a Ren and Stimpy poster in the back. He has, like, stuffed toys on the wall.
Yeah, of all things, he's got a stuffed Blood Wolf.
Yeah, Blood Wolf. I noticed that. He has a toy of himself. It's a little narcissistic. And he's dressed like out of a 90s hip-hop video with the giant overalls.
Backward turnball cap.
Yeah, the deformed-looking tennis shoes.
Yeah, those things are... Those are not feet that he's got in his legs, let me tell you that. Clearly, Jeff Matsuda is letting you know that Rob Liefeld isn't the only guy who had some issues with feet.
He's housed in the same base as the way they were keeping Overkill?
I believe so, yeah. They actually get into... There's an origin story that's going to run in two issues of Strikefile where they kind of get into that. But yeah, I believe he's in the same Pentagon lab or a Pentagon-adjacent lab where they're keeping Overkill.
The Youngbloods didn't have like an Avengers Tower or anything?
Well, no, I think that Youngblood actually was based within the Pentagon. Okay. But I think that Bad Rock, because he's, you know, I mean, I don't want to cast aspersions, but he's kind of deformed and he weighs tons. You know, he doesn't function well. So I think they have him in this lab as opposed... He sort of like hangs out at Star Labs, basically, rather than hanging out at Titan's Tower.
So he's more like... what was that character from DC? The one that has all the different chemicals in him.
Metamorpho.
Yeah, where he kind of hangs around the lab. Doesn't really leave the lab.
Metamorpho?
Yeah. I'm reading the new Terrifics.
Oh, okay. I've never read Terrifics. I wonder where they were doing that.
Don't. Trust me.
You were on that Lee Meyer kick, right?
Yes. Well, I was giving DC another shot, and we'll talk about that another day. Yeah. These soldiers are trying to take out Overkill, and he's just kind of laughing off their blast with his chains. He runs into Die Hard?
Yeah, and Shaft.
And they start battling a little bit. Punchy, punchy, kicky, kicky. Now, Die Hard is a cyborg as well, right?
It's never been super clear. I really can't tell you. I don't know if he's an android or a robot or a cyborg or what. There's some human element to him, but I don't know if he actually has flesh in there somewhere or if it's just like his brain engrams or what.
I might be thinking of Super Patriot then.
Super Patriot is definitely a cyborg, yeah.
Yeah.
And you remember Die Hard and Super Patriot fought each other in an earlier issue of Strike File.
Yeah, so that's what I was saying. I always wondered if he was an android or is he a cyborg or what is he?
Yeah, I hope they eventually resolve that, but I can't tell you for sure.
They kind of seem to be going one-to-one and then all of a sudden...
Well, I do like that there's a line of dialogue here where he says, when last we battled, six of you could barely hold your own against me, and this time there are only two. And then Die Hard's like, true, but it's two of the best.
Yeah.
So definitely he did fight Youngblood in a story that may or may not have ever been recorded.
Another off book. Okay. And they're battling. Shaft shoots him with an arrow. And I guess these are like acid arrows?
He's got the full Hawkeye compliment. Yeah.
Yeah. He's like blasting him and hitting him. And he's as he's recovering from these arrow hit, that's when Badrock shows up. They get into punchy, kicky, kicky. And Badrock seems to be really kicking the shit out of him. And then apparently Overkill has his new superpower where he powers up his punches. And, you know, him and Badrock are going back and forth, and he's, I guess, shooting a laser?
Oh,
yay, nay?
No, it's something. I mean, he's always got, it's just sort of, you see, like, energy, but also, like, it could be fire, it could be, like, the explosion of projectiles. It's not really clear.
Yeah, all you know is Bedrock is going flying back, Overt Current turns around, who's gonna die first? Shaft hits him with some arrows. They, I guess, are exploding arrows, or...
I think they're acidic, and they're really, really effective. It's funny because, you know, Bedrock's on the cover, and he's the guy who gets gets most of the dialogue, and you get the sense that he's supposed to be the guy who's going one-on-one against Overkill, but really, of all the people, the one you'd least expected, it's Shaft and his damned acid arrows that really take him out.
Yeah. I mean, at one point, you see Overt running away, and he's losing an arm and a leg, and he seems to be just kind of a stump, one arm, a third of a leg, kind of dragging himself around the floor. Youngblood thinks they got him. He's laughing, and then they do that one trick where his head launches and starts to fly around.
I really think this was the first time they did that.
That got into the toys, too. I remember at one point seeing a toy like that, right?
I believe
where
so, yeah.
Would pop off.
Yeah, he didn't have that gimmick in the first toy, I don't think, but I believe it was the second one that his head popped off, yeah.
And so he's like, the joke's on you, and he's flying away, and he's laughing. And
yeah, tell me something. Was there ever a character in comics that did that, where they could pop their head off and send their head flying, or was that a unique thing? Because I know Liefeld did the wannabe Weapon X Kane, and he would shoot his hands off, and that was sort of a riff on the old Shogun Warriors, but I don't remember anybody who would actually shoot their head and send their head flying and stuff. I don't know if there's maybe like a Terry Gilliam character or something like that where that was.
Well,
no,
I mean, Baron Munchausen in the Moon, that was played by Robert Williams, but that's no.
Baron Munchausen would have predated this, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that's that famous scene with Robin Williams where he's the man on the moon and his head's floating around and his body's chasing him around. It's kind of a cool scene. I'm trying to think, is there any characters? I want to say there is, but I can't for the life of me think of a character right now where his head launches, except for maybe like Silvermane. Yeah.
From Marvel, the Mafia Cyborg.
The Spider-Man villain.
Wait, Mafia Cyborg? That sounds oddly familiar.
Yeah.
Oh, shit. Okay. I was trying to give some credit to Image, but you're doing a good job of tearing that apart.
I just remember there's a really good series, you know, about the Sinister Six where they're kind of the it's coming from the view of the beat on them, and Silvermane's in there, and he's a Mafia Cyborg whose head gets launched and flies around and gets stuck on a little RV car or RC car, and he's using that to travel around. That's the only one I can think of. Mm-hmm. And he predates this, absolutely. So
what else happened?
So he's laughing and his head's flying around, and apparently this is one thing Shaft can't shoot in the air, is a moving target.
Diehard's the one he's flying after and pursuing.
Oh, no, Diehard, yeah, but you have Overt Kill basically go between Bad Rock and Shaft, and I just assume Shaft would have been a cool scene of like thud thud, and you see Overt's head stuck to the wall with an arrow through its ear, and apparently not.
This is a pretty decisive lack of victory for Overkill, 2-for-2, where he's almost entirely obliterated. So I guess the one thing he has going for him is because he's so lightweight and he's got so much propulsion that it's sort of like a car versus a motorcycle. Die Hard tries to chase after him, and that head just flies so fast and so far that Die Hard can't do anything about it.
They do the whole thing where he's flying in the high atmosphere and he freezes up, a la Iron Man.
You'd really think the head would freeze up a lot.
Iron Man, of course, I know. Yeah.
You'd think the head would freeze up a lot faster than the robot superhero, though.
True, but apparently Die Hard is less advanced than Overt Kill.
Or maybe there's more human in him than there is in Overt Kill. I mean, there was next to nothing left of him.
Well,
so
they figured out the whole Frost problem with the Overt Kill model.
I just think Overt Kill is almost entirely synthetic. I think that while he appears to have a human head, I don't think there's actually much human in there.
It has to be, dude. I mean, the personality, unless now they're making sentient robots that are cool with being mobsters. That's kind of weird. Mm-hmm. But I mean, it is Image. Die Hard crashes onto the lawn of the Pentagon as Overt Kill is slowly flying away laughing.
Well, specifically, he lands on the grounds of the Washington Monument.
Monument, yes. And at this point, I'm assuming Overt Kill is going back to Tony Twist and shows up, and he's basically sitting there floating above Tony's desk laughing, saying, "We need to talk." And then it stops.
Yeah, it's so sad because the whole point of him getting recovered by the government was so they'd pay to give him a new body. And here we are with just the head left over. So I guess it's going to come out of Tony's pocket after all.
It's a prime Layfield. Take it as you will.
What do you think about Jeff Matsuda's art?
I really thought it was Layfield who drew this until we got to the feet.
Dude, there's no way. That doesn't look anything like Liefeld.
It's very similar, man.
No way, dude. This looks nothing like Liefeld.
You don't think so?
Look, it's flashy period Chromium Age artwork, but the characters look nothing like the way Liefeld draws them.
No. There are some very, very bad panels, especially the one where we were talking about where Shaft is launching the arrows and you see Overt Kill being, I guess, hit with those acid arrows or whatever, and you look at Bedrock from behind. I didn't know that was Bad Rock. I was like, who's the fat character? It just, the proportions of them look all so weird. weird. But
Bad Rock is Liefeldian enough where I can definitely see that. It's tough to draw Bad Rock to make him look like he doesn't look like Liefeld's version of the character because he's so overwrought with Liefeldisms. Kind of a chubby guy too, which is one of the things I think is cool about Bad Rock is that his body type isn't typical. You know, they usually want to have him all cut and everything, and he was probably a chubby kid who got transformed into Bad Rock. His anatomy is so specifically Liefeldian, it does look like Liefeld's drawing him.
Dude, he looks like concrete.
He does look like concrete.
You just buff if you pumped a little steroids into concrete, you get Bad Rock. Even the faces, dude, are so damn similar.
I actually think that concrete's a little more defined than Bad Rock.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, the artwork. Oh, yeah, I guess, yeah, because he has, like, the little chips and cracks. And
yeah, he looks like a marble pillar or something, where Bad Rock looks like a chubby rock.
Yeah.
Or like, he doesn't even really look that rocky when you think about it, though. He just looks like he's kind of gray with odd features.
Well, because they try to show, like, muscular features through the concrete.
Yeah, he's got veins and stuff. Yeah, the veins are definitely unusual.
Yeah. Now, let me ask you, how long do you think it took them to do an issue? Like drawing the issue.
I don't know, man. The 90s were a weird time. I mean,
really?
I mean, these books were coming out late and these were new talents. You know, Jeff Matsuda, I don't think he'd done much of anything before this comic book. I believe this was probably his first full length comic book. But I do think a lot of detail is placed on this, but the books were always running late too, so it's really hard to tell. I do think that a lot of effort was put into this. I do think it's a young penciler, so there's areas where it's just not so hot. Weird because some of it kind of reminds me of Pat Lee. I don't think Pat Lee ever got that great. Yeah. So, but
some, to me, the artwork felt rushed.
I don't think it's so much rushed. I think it's more about someone who's still learning how, figuring out what their style is going to be and learning how to draw. But I do think that there's some decent storytelling for a raw young artist. And I do think there's a lot of detailing in place. And I'm sure Danny Meekie had a lot to do with that. That guy's a really strong inker, really detailed inker. I do think that he works better when he's doing the more cartoony stuff. I do think more of his personality shows there. He went on to work in animation, so that makes sense. Where when he's trying to do the more darker realistic kind of stuff, like I think there's even a little bit of Jay Lee in there where he's trying for it, and it's just not where his strengths lie. But I think overall, it's a pretty decent looking story. I like the look of it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to hate on it too much. It's acceptable art.
It's a big, dumb action story, but it's you know, for a big, dumb action story, I thought it was fun and moved fairly fast. You know, it for Image, I think it was pretty solid.
But what'd you think of the storytelling, though?
I mean, it wasn't anything special. Again, it's mostly a big action thing, and it was a way to set up the return of Overkill. It accomplished what he was going for. I'd have been really pissed off if I'd paid $2.50 for the fucking thing, picking up out of cheapy bins and stuff. I was perfectly satisfied. You grade on a different scale. If I'm paying $2.50 in $1992, I'm fucking pissed off. But it's solid quarter bin material. And I like that it does some universe building. I like that it alludes to this past history. I do kind of want to see if that story ever happened. I like that there is, at this point, still an Image universe to speak of.
All right. You defended enough.
Plus, I kind of like, I'm done. I have enough of that.
Yeah, I was going to say, man, you cannot suck this dick any harder, man. Yeah. It's done. It's flaccid.
Yes. Okay, cool.
Hey, everybody, welcome to Spotometer. I'm a Lee Machine, and with me is...
We're not. I don't think you're doing intros on that. I guess you can't really want to, but...
Today, we're going
to
talk about Youngblood Yearbook.
July 27th, 1993. Feel free.
Youngblood Yearbook creator, Rob Liefeld. Story, Eric Stevenson. Pencils, Chep Yeep. Inks, Norm Rapamund. Rapamund? I think I've been pronouncing his name wrong for 30 fucking years. Is this the Youngblood Strike Force, or which Youngblood is this?
That's the away team.
Okay.
When they get their own series, the book is Team Youngblood, but technically, I think they're just the Youngblood away team. Wizard Holofoil Card Series Number 3, Rob Liefeld's Youngblood. Team Leaders, Sentinel. Team Roster, Riptide, Cougar, Brahma, Photon, and Sci-Fire. First appearance, the Megaton Explosion, 1987, created by Rob Liefeld. So this is clearly the away team. The Youngblood away team was created to handle crisis situations and preserve U.S. interests overseas. Be it a rescue, assault, or reconnaissance mission, this team of superpowered commandos can turn any no-win situation around and come out on top. The team is led by the high-tech armored Sentinel and consists of Riptide, a beautiful witch with a magical ability ability to control water. Cougar, the animalistic bad boy of the group. Brahma, the towering muscle man. Photon, the energy-wielding warrior from the planet Valencia. And Sci-Fire, the telepathic, telekinetic, pyrokinetic loose cannon. 8.5 out of 10 on the kiboshometer. Oh, they specifically say a team kiboshometer, which is opposed to the regular kiboshometer for a single person, which is a good distinction to make.
All right, this is the story of the Youngblood Away team headed to Antarctica to investigate why some, like, communication science
outpost
has gone offline. They get there, everything's all messed, fucked up. I can say fucked up in this.
Yeah, spawnometer.
Okay. All messed up. They run across these goons.
And you really need to say messed up.
Yeah. Huh? They fight Youngblood, and as they run these guys off, they go into some portal.
There's this long tunnel that goes on for, like, miles or something.
Yeah. And they're, like, end up in, like, a savage land, basically.
They fought barbarians with cybernetic parts, or they had advanced weaponry or something, but they're basically still barbarians.
Yeah.
And they followed them there, yeah.
When they get there, they get captured.
I think they allowed themselves to be captured to investigate, yeah. Basically.
And there's this dude, what's his name? His name's Tyrax, explaining he came to Antarctica, like, a long time ago, I think.
Well, I think the whole thing is, okay, he's a blue-skinned alien dude who is, like, a foot soldier for some alien race, and he finds this backwater planet, and it's like, shit, I can conquer these fuckers. So he does, and they force him to make him, like, the king of the barbarians, and once he realizes that this planet has these portals to go to other planets, he tries to use the barbarian forces to conquer those places, too.
Arcadia is the name of the place he conquered. He's doing his regular supervillain explaining of everything.
Expositing,
to the folks that he probably shouldn't be explaining stuff to. A bunch of dudes show up, a guy by the name of Kanan. He and his dudes were indigenous to this planet, and when Tyrax took over, they were sort of cast aside, and they've been trying
to... For clarity, can we say who these people actually are? It's Kazar.
Yeah. I mean, his name is Kanan instead of...
Yeah, so it's and looks just like Kazar, long blonde hair, Tarzan motherfucker. Yeah.
In a savage land.
Peak imaging going on in here.
So they help free Youngblood away
team. No. This has been discussed. So one of the selling points of this book is that it was the first four-part gatefold story page. What are we getting treated to in this four page?
Okay, we have this enormous splash page, right? That a normal splash page would be 2 pages. This is four, as Deb LeFranc pointed out. It is Spartan? Who is this dude?
Sentinel.
Say? Sentinel charging a dude's, like, sort of back silhouette, and the guy's back and head stretch across 3 pages. And then you got, like, what's her name?
Riptides.
Get, like, a weird wave. That takes up 2 pages. Who is this guy?
Brahma. He's the big muscle dude.
Brahma Bull, right? He's, like, throwing a punch at a guy and hitting him. That's on 1 page. And then this Kanan guy is taking up an entire page with just his face, hair, and part of his arm throwing a punch.
Punching somebody off panel.
It's about as little detail as you could possibly have in a 4-page spread.
Yeah. Well, and this is the only real fight sequence in the book for the most part. There's a little bit of tussling earlier on. And this is an extra length special and everything. 4 pages to something that could have been a panel. What I do like about the 4-page spread is it has all of these spotlight ads that ran in places like Wizard were all over the place. Like, really low-key promoting Team Youngblood's launch.
On the backside of the 4-page, right?
And you've got, like, a spotlight image of Cougar, and they don't even tell you whether it's promoting. You got a spotlight image of Sentinel, they don't tell you what it's promoting. But then in the middle of the spread, it tells you Liefeld, Stevenson, Yape, Rapmund, Team Youngblood, on sale in September. And there were actually a couple of other ones. There was one with Masada, who's not in this story, and I think they did one other one too. And you always saw these things in Wizards, and it's weird because it's just a pinup, and you go for page after page until you finally got what they were promoting. But if you didn't know that there was a connection between those things, it just looked like a random pinup. But what's funny is the same artist who does those pinups does the interiors, but you couldn't hardly tell because the art of this book is shit.
Yeah, it's really bad.
And then it's actually pretty good pinups. And it's the same art team. It's even the same inker.
Yep.
Well, some of them anyway. There is some editorial material in there where Rob Liefeld's thinking, this guy's improving by leaps and bounds with every issue. And it's like, good, because this first one looks like trash.
It's bad, but not as bad. Yeah, I mean, this last page here, this is just
it really looks like the worst. Like, it looks like one of those deals where somebody self-published it for, like, their immediate region, like their city, or like, it doesn't look like
where they're stapling this shit at home.
It's not professional caliber work at all. A complete lack of fundamentals even. So I guess he must have done some nice pinups and they gave him this special. I don't know how he managed to get the series. Go ahead. The cover is reproduced as a pinup, but without this dumb black border. I think it's maybe different colors too.
Possibly. Gotta be. It's got its okay panels in it. But really, like, this last page is borderline offensive. I'm offended by it. And these are all just like pinups at the back, right?
Yeah, a lot of pinups. But I kind of dig it.
Is it Byrne?
It looks a lot like John Byrne. I think it's the dude's name Bridges. I think it was like Victor Bridges. He ended up doing Freak Force for Eric Larson, but he did a really nice riff on Byrne, just elongated. Feels like they kind of like stretched everybody out. They're all taller than they would be if Byrne was doing them.
There's a Kevin McGuire.
Yeah, I think that's a nice shot there.
It's okay. Was it Scott Williams?
Now, David Anton Williams. It's a two-page Williams. Spread of the Berserkers and a shot of Prophet. Berserkers didn't really amount to much, even though they kind of launched Image Comics, because if Marvel had just let Liefeld do his Executioner's book for Malibu, Image may have never happened. But not really a major footprint in comics history otherwise.
And then there's another one that he did of Shaft.
Yeah. I've got a piece by him. I love it. It's one of my favorite pieces that I own. It's gorgeous.
Who's this one?
But it's one of my own characters, so I'm not going to put it out there.
Ah, gotcha. Who's C. Alexander?
I think that's Chris Alexander, and I did not care for those. It's another shot of the Youngblood home team, but I think
I like the texture on
Bad Rock. Mm-hmm. And then same another dude one? Doing the away team.
And that's not good.
Nope. Dusty Able doing sort of like a hybrid of the two teams. I like Dusty Able in general, but it's not a good combination, and I don't think he's doing inspired work there either.
Then we got more ads.
The Image Plus put their ads
Shadow
in the back.
Hawk, yeah. Vanguard, Dooms, so, 4.
So this is Jason Pearson.
Really yeah, this one's
and
really
I really
good.
Like that one. It's kind of got a Brian Stelfreeze thing going on. And this is the home team, Chapel, Die Hard, Shaft.
Wait, we didn't finish Vogue, the story.
What is the end of the story?
Okay, so then Kanak, whatever was his name?
Kanan. It's biblical. Liefeld does a lot of biblical stuff.
Kanan spring young blood, and then they kind of tussle for a little bit, and then basically he's like, you guys have to get the fuck out of here because he's about to close this portal. So they like rush to get out of there, and they make it through Antarctica right as the portal closes, and they're left to wonder if they could ever make it back to Acadia to help Kanan.
I'm pretty sure they took the name from the quasi Duran Duran album. Simon Le Bon and some other guys from Duran Duran had a side band called Acadia. They did like one album and like one popular single came off of it, and then they went back to being Duran Duran. And I don't know if any of these dudes ever show up again, because I mean the story's called This Savage Land. There's no
oh my god, really? I guess I totally missed what the name of the actual story was. Wow, they even call it The Savage Land, basically.
This Savage Land.
Well, I guess that makes it different.
It's McDougal's, not McDonald's.
Yeah.
Overall thoughts?
Pretty not great.
Yeah.
But it was a pretty easy read, too, so it's like it was the worst thing in the world.
They made excellent use of splash pages and lax dialogue to just burn through the motherfucker.
And because of all the pinups, it feels like it's going to just be this enormous, like, old-school Marvel annual, and it's not. It's a pretty short story.
Yeah, and I think they stole the yearbook name from G.I. Joe. G.I. Joe didn't do annuals, they did yearbooks. Mm. But I thought that was kind of cool. They don't all have to be annuals.
Right.
And, of course, they only came out with one year's book.
And never happened again?
Nope, I don't think so.
All right, good enough.
Everyone looks the same.
Mm-hmm.
If it wasn't for the skin tone, I couldn't tell who's who, except for Riptide and that other guy. They all kind of look like saber-toothed clones or knockoffs.
How would you qualify the art? Is it pretty bad?
Again, art is subjective, so I would say, is it, what was that name of that artist that did EarthX?
Was that Tony Edwards who did that one, or John Paul Leone?
Don Paul Leone, yeah. That being the bottom of the scale, and the top of the scale, in my book, being something like a Art Adams, this is closer to the other guy. This is no Art Adams.
I feel like probably at no point in history has there ever been an instance of Chap Yape being ranked above John Paul Leone. Not
really?
Just because of like subjective taste, but just because whoever talks about either one of these assholes.
He's definitely a clone. Like, they all look like Liefeld clones. I couldn't tell the next from the other.
I would actually say that stylistically, he looks the least like Liefeld of the people that are closely associated with him.
Passable. Shamed, I'm pretty sure I bought this book back in the day and probably never read it.
This led into Team Youngblood. I'll cover the first three issues in a quick rip. The first issue came out September 20th, 1993, so just a couple of months after the yearbook, and Team Youngblood actually kept up a monthly schedule for the most part.
For how long?
I've made it 6 issues so far, and it's pretty much on schedule throughout that.
Okay.
So the first story arc opens with a guy who totally looks like Nick Fury, but apparently he's Colonel Haver, who is the boss of a satellite called Liberty 2. There's a ship that's coming to the satellite, and there's tons of reasons to be suspicious of the thing, but the fucking asshole lets the ship on anyway, even though he himself, you know, smoking his stogie, totally being Nick Fury, points out, I really shouldn't do this, and then he does it, and then the fucking place gets taken over by Geiger and Cybernet, and so this satellite controls communications, the flow of electricity for some reason. Also, apparently it's going to give them access to nukes at some point if they can manage to work that out. So just way too much going on with the Liberty 2 satellite. Kiever, who I think was the undersecretary of Graves in the Youngblood books, he's the guy who acts like Graves for Team Youngblood. He kind of runs that group. So Kiever's going to send Team Youngblood up against Geiger, but the team's in a bad place. They're going to have to make some adjustments before they can go on this mission. Over the course of the story, we see the Spawn anchors, the three people that are always in the Spawn comics, commenting on Geiger's takeover. And you also get to see some international anchors that I don't think ever appear anywhere else. In the last chapter of the story, you get cameos from Spawn, Prophet, Kirby, Savage Dragon, Battlestone, and some members of Brigade, because they're all concerned that maybe they need to get involved in helping with the satellite issue, but they already know how they could, or they're in a situation where they can't. But it was some nice cameos that remind you that there is an Image universe. Sentinel ultimately is the main guy who does most of the fighting against Geiger, manages to set it up to where he broadcasts the defeat of Geiger and his seeming death globally. So everybody gets to see what a big hero Sentinel is over the course of this. Just to give you a rundown of the characters and what they're up to over these issues, you've got Brahma, the big blonde guy. He's taken up drinking. I don't know what happened to him. Maybe it had something to do with the Darkthorn episode from the first Youngblood story arc, or maybe it's just a decline in general. But he's hard drinking. He's living with his dad and yelling at his dad. When the pager, it goes off for him to go on this mission, he just smashes it. He wants nothing to do with it. He ultimately goes AWOL. He meets up with Showdown, that weird ninja chick from the early Youngblood issues that apparently was a member of Youngblood at one point. So he's talking to her about maybe going to the dark side, I guess, getting a feel for her, just letting her know that he's probably not going to be in Youngblood anymore. And he calls Riptide to tell her the same thing, that, look, I'm out. We get introduced to Dutch.
Wasn't he like a little bit of Cable, but he had like a weird rabbit ear type things, like robotic Gundam look to his helmet?
Maybe, but I think you're probably thinking of Colonel Bravo.
Oh.
Dutch was the dude in the purple outfit with the little green things. He wore a face mask.
Mm-hmm.
Dutch was with Cybernet, and I think he had a cameo in the Youngblood Genesis, but he betrayed Geiger at the urging of Sentinel. But even though he worked with Youngblood to go up against Cybernet, he still ended up doing 5 years in prison and blamed Sentinel for that. But he ultimately agrees to be recruited by Sentinel to go on this mission, mostly because he hates Geiger so much he wants an opportunity to take another shot at him. And it's funny because the whole scene plays out very similar to when Troutman's going after Rambo in Rambo First Blood Part 2.
Okay.
Then you got Riptide, who of course is the one who controls water. Extremely powerful person. She's the only other member of the Team Youngblood besides Dutch and Sentinel that do anything against Geiger. The rest of them are just sort of sitting around. I think she absorbs the water in the satellite and knocks out most of the people and maybe fucks up some of the electronics and shit.
Mm-hmm.
So do you remember which one Photon is?
The one has it like energy, right? Coming off of him?
Right. The one with the fire hair and the pointy mask and shit.
Yeah.
So he does, despite seemingly being a powerful guy with all the energy projection and shit, he does jack fucking shit in all the issues that I've read so far of Team Youngblood. All he does is fly around and speak in broken English.
Really? I thought he did like projectile, like liquid lasers or some weird shit like that.
He shoots blasts, but he doesn't do anything. He doesn't actually accomplish anything.
Okay.
So we're introduced to a new member, Masada. She speaks in Yiddish 101 because of course she's Jewish. They gave her a backstory in Youngblood Strike File number 6. It was a solo story by Tom and Mary Beerbohm, Chris Sprouse, and John Beatty. And it explains that her name is Deborah Konigsberg. She's a size-changing, super-strong person, and she's powered by the souls of Jewish heroes, like people who've fallen in defense of the Jewish nation and the Jewish faith. In the story, she has an old friend that was tied up with Mossad, but he's gone rogue, and he's trying to assassinate basically Louis Farrakhan. And she manages to stop him, and he ends up shooting himself in the head. Her heroism and Farrakhan, or the Farrakhan stand-in's unwillingness to recognize her heroism, as he condemns Jews because he's a mage, like rabid anti-Semite, and makes some of his own followers question whether or not, you know, he was a good guy or not. So, all right, little story, unless you're with the Nation of Islam. So then we go to Team Youngblood number 4. That was like the issue where they decided they were going to slow down and do a bunch of character work. So they show Sentinel at a press conference explaining what all happened on the satellite. We're introduced to a reporter named Jack Leeds, who's got a major axe to grind and plans on trying to take Youngblood down on his own. Team Youngblood number 5 is all about Cougar. Do you remember Cougar?
Yeah, the Wolverine clone.
Yeah, he was actually supposed to be a member of the New Mutants. I remember in an issue of Marvel Age magazine, they showed a cover with him like leaping out. And what had happened is Liefeld actually gave away a couple of his Youngblood characters to the New Mutants. Thumbelina was supposed to be a Youngblood villain, and she ended up in the Mutant Liberation Front. And I think her name was Sonic, the black chick with the helmet, was supposed to be, she was like one of the founding Youngblood characters that appeared in a lot of the materials from when it was going to be published by Megaton.
Yeah.
But since he sold her off to Marvel, she ended up being a Marvel character, and he never, to my knowledge, used her in any of his own Image books. You probably remember her, though. Do you remember the Peter David story in X-Factor where they went up against the Mutant Liberation Front?
No.
There was a scientist who figures out how to abort mutant babies, like to determine if a baby's going to be a mutant. That she was the one who tipped off X-Factor to try to shut down that operation.
Okay, I didn't know that.
Or it might have been the opposite. Maybe she might have tipped him off to prevent the Mutant Liberation Front from shutting it down. I think it was that way. I think she wanted to make sure that people had the right. She was a pro-choice, if I remember correctly.
Wait, was this in Marvel?
Yeah, this was Marvel.
Holy shit.
It was one of the issues. I think Larry Stroman drew it.
Take it they didn't promote it heavily.
Well, I mean, it was a mutant book, so it still sold like a motherfucker.
Wow. I'm going to have to find that book. I'm interested now. I'm a little curious.
Cougar was going to get sold off to Marvel, and Liefeld thought better of it. He ends up in Youngblood and then Team Youngblood. And it's kind of a shame because he is a fucking pussy throughout all the Team Youngblood issues I've read. He's constantly the guy who gets knocked out first. He gets nailed with an energy blast or gets whacked, and he's just out for most of the adventure. He sucks.
What do you think he would get for a figure or a character? What do you think Liefeld gets paid for?
I don't know. I think he actually made a pretty decent little chunk of change in the early days. I don't know if it was a joke or what, but I remember hearing a story where at one point Marvel paid him for essentially a list of nouns. There were supposed to be the names of characters, and they actually paid him for essentially a list of nouns.
Oh, holy shit.
Yeah, or maybe that might have just been a joke that they ran in Doom Force. I'm not sure how that plays. So Cougar, as you know, he's just like a Wolverine type guy. His origin is that, okay, let me see if I can remember all this. There's supposed to be a race of cat people in Africa. There's a paleobotanist that wants to get to like an ancient believed extinct vegetation or something. A party is led into the cat people's territory. They don't believe the legends of the cat people. They end up getting slaughtered by the cat people, of course. And so the only one that's left alive is the paleobotanist because the king of the cat people fancies her. Even though the cat people all want to kill her, and they do force her to strip, and it makes me wonder if there wasn't some more stuff going on with while she was captive. But the king keeps her around, ends up mating with her, and that's how Cougar gets born. Is he's a half human, half cat person.
Okay.
Yeah, very, very, very strange. Obviously, they come back to the States because the cat people can't tolerate this hybrid being amongst them. So they try to kill Cougar when he's a baby and his mom, and the king sacrifices his life to make sure they escape. They end up living in the United States and get recruited by Youngblood, and that's how Cougar ends up with that group. But at some point, his mom gets kidnapped, and they lure him back to Africa to fight these people. He fights one person in particular named Lynx, who is a cat woman along the lines of Feral, and she's one of those people who's been featured in Youngblood artworks since the very beginning. That one cover that Jerry Ordway inked that ran in that Megaton holiday special, and she's in there. That's Lynx, okay?
Okay.
She forces Cougar to fight her in order to be the king of the cat people, but he kicks her ass the only time he beats anybody, and it occurs to me he's beating up the lady. Don't get me wrong, I'm all about equality and shit, but the one time he gets to succeed, he's beating up a chick. As I say, he's a pussy. Because he beat Lynx and he put down this attempted coup, he reinforces that he is, in fact, the king of the cat people. Then he fucks off with Team Youngblood for a while and ignores them and leaves his mom in charge, which doesn't go over well. So they start poisoning his mom, and she's in peril of getting indebted. So that's part of the setup of a three-part story they did in Youngblood Strike File number 9 through 11. The first part was titled King of the Cats, and it was by Robert Lauren Fleming, Tom Tenney, and Charlie Adlard. Now, do you remember Tom Tenney?
No.
Do you remember Forceworks?
Yes.
The guy who did all the squish faces and all the weird, like...
Yeah.
What'd you think of him?
Well, the fact that No.
And he did the part of the Chapel miniseries, too.
Okay.
The guy seemed to flake out on a bunch of books, and what's funny is he only draws the first chapter, and so of all people, they get Charlie Adler to ink that first chapter. Do you remember Charlie Adler?
Yes, I remember some of Charlie Adler's work.
Walking Dead, man.
Yeah.
And back then, that was like before he took over X-Files, and that was like his first brush with big success. Not a similar artist to Tom Tenney at all. So I think what they did is they got Charlie Adler to ink it because he drew the other two chapters and they were trying to give it some visual consistency, but it's still an odd pairing.
That is strange.
So what happens, this is a weird fucking story, okay? Basically, Rum Tum Tugger shows up to make Cougar less of a pussy. The backstory is apparently there's a king of house cats. I assume it's just house cats, but it might be all cats. So this king dies, and so there's this house cat that's being like tormented by kids and stuff, and apparently he's next in succession, so the soul goes into him, and he like explodes with energy and flies out of this house and leaves his family gobsmacked. And then he becomes almost like a Lobo looking guy. He's all ripped out and he wears like metal gear and stuff. It's nuts. His name is Slink. He takes it upon himself to train Cougar to be a better cat person. So now he can climb the sides of buildings like skyscrapers and then jump off the skyscrapers. And because he can position himself a certain way, he can fall from a skyscraper, and as long as he lands on his feet, he's okay, just like a cat.
So, does he have nine lives as well? Like, he can sacrifice a life?
Strangely, no. That's the one place they didn't go. But what they did do is they did the thing where he can, like, dislocate his bones, or if his bones are supposed to be more malleable. But as long, just like a cat, as long as he can get his head through something, he can get the rest of his body through something. He has a new squeezing power.
That just sounds so weird.
He's got a cat tongue. He can suddenly talk to all felines, like Aquaman, but with cats.
So he speaks Slytherin.
Feline, yeah. He can mesmerize people, be in a hypnotic trance for a short period of time, and be susceptible to suggestion. And the weirdest choice is, apparently there's pathways that only cats can reach, and you can use this pathway to connect points on the earth, like ley lines. Now he can teleport. He can walk through this hedge maze and go from the U.S. to Africa whenever he needs to.
Okay, that's just weird.
So in the story, we find out that Lynx is actually Cougar's half-sister, that apparently she was the daughter of the king's first wife, and when the wife died in childbirth, he blamed the baby and cast Lynx out of the kingdom. But she does have a legitimate claim to ruling the cat people. But of course, especially with his new powers, Cougar and his mentor Slink kick her ass and basically say, okay, well, you're still going to be in exile, but we'll try to work something out with you because I feel bad because you're my half-sister and shit. And now that I can teleport, I'll be more of a king than I had been before. I won't be so absentee. And that's not only how the three-part story ends, but that's also the last story in the last issue of Strike File.
Okay, I think you made it sound more interesting than it probably really was.
No, it actually isn't that bad. It's just fucking weird.
What?
But it's not bad. No, it's actually not a bad read. But it, for no other reason than for the what the fuck quality of it.
Okay, I mean, it sounds weird as shit.
It is. Oh, 100% it is weird as shit. The last issue of Team Youngblood Recovering, issue number 6. Do you remember Sci-Fire?
Sci-Fire, no.
So he was the guy who had the telekinetic, telepathy, energy projection thing going on. He's the guy who killed Saddam Hussein.
Oh, yeah, I remember that. Yeah, I remember that issue.
So this guy's been in a coma since Youngblood fought Darkthorn in the first major story arc, the extended story arc that ended with number 5. He comes out of his coma briefly, and he possesses a girl that was working at the Pentagon, I guess. He uses her as his proxy and starts killing people, like serial killing, the stupidest thing he could do because it's not at all productive. It's not helping him at all. He draws Youngblood back to their base to try to kill them all, and he fails because he tries to get into the mind of Masada. But as I mentioned, she's powered by all these Jewish souls, and apparently they're constantly always talking to her and driving her a little bit nuts. He's overwhelmed by all the souls, and he just like passes out, and that's the end of his threat. While we're here too, I read Spawn number 300, and I chose the J. Scott Campbell cover because I've always really liked the way J. Scott Campbell draws Spawn. He hasn't done it very often, but he did it for a Wizard cover, which I think also featured Spider-Man. He's a great Spider-Man artist too. One of the reasons why I remember it is I was a retailer at the time, and they had one of those retailer circulars. They had a black and white version of the cover. I used that. I traced over it and colored over it, and I made like my own version of Spawn that's a little bit closer to what I thought Spawn was going to be when he was first introduced. I read Spawn 300, and it gives no fucks about introducing anything to anybody. It's working under the assumption that if you haven't read the issues up to this point, then you better go out and buy some, because it's not going to get you up to speed. But it's like multiple chapters, and they get a bunch of different guest artists, including J. Scott Campbell for a few pages. Capullo comes back for a few pages. They're showing the countdown to 47. The spawnometer is down to 47. I want to say they fucked the spawnometer in the past, though, so I don't know when they started the count on this version of it. Mm-hmm. What a bad read. Despite being thrown into the deep end, it was somewhat interesting what they were doing. They made some changes to Violator to make him a different kind of character. Appreciate it, because I was never that big of a Violator fan. And bringing in some other villains of his. Spawn looked cool in that one. They gave him like a little bit of a redesign. Maybe Crow influenced. And I'm somewhat interested in reading 301. It ends on a cliffhanger. Unfortunately, it doesn't wrap up the story arc.
What?
Yeah, no. It's like instead of it ending at 300, it's like going to be 301. I think in part because you don't surpass Cerebus with a 300th issue. You surpass it with a 301st. So that for him, that was the actual momentous moment. I haven't read 301 yet, but I would certainly consider it. But I was a little bit lost. Maybe I'll pick up the trade. I'm not sure. But I just figured I'd give it a shout out since I happen to pick up 300.
So this is a current issue.
301 is out now.
Who wrote this?
Several people, including Scott Snyder. But Todd McFarlane is the main guy. I think that they were just like scripting over him or something. I like the cover.
It's weird. The logo is so small.
It like fits between his collar.
Well, I think it's custom for just this cover. It might have even been Jake Campbell who drew in that logo. I think he's trying to incorporate it into the stained glass background.
About time they finally brought in She-Spawn. I don't think they've ever brought her in before.
And if you read the story, she's a notable character from Spawn lore too.
Really?
But I think that we're getting into spoiler territory here, so I kind of want to lay off that one.
Hey, Jake.
You and me, we record the Spawn episode, and then we record some Trencher material, and over the course of recording the Spawn episode, I realized that there was a bunch of stuff we needed to get covered before episode 26, and so even as we're recording the Trencher stuff, I know we're not going to be able to use it. On the drive home, as I hit the freeway, I realized that in all the confusion, I'd forgotten to do the mail segment, the spawning ground, and I wasn't going to release an episode without the mail segment, so to a large degree, one of the reasons why there hasn't been a Spawnometer in a few months is just because of the stupid fucking mail, unfortunately.
That sounds about right. That sounds like us.
Let me go over the mail right quick. Our Spawnomaniacs, let's go with. What the fuck? Why not? We got the 108 Stage, Adriano, All the Pouches and Image Comics Podcast, Dr. Ange, Between the Pages, Cash Flag, Christopher Bush, Coffee and Comics, Dr. G Nerdologist, Ed Moore at Teal Productions, El Romero Mero, Eli, El Queen, oh shit, Estupor Profundo, Guts Last Sword, The Hammer Strikes Random Geeky Stuff, Harmless Entertainment, History of Comics on Film, Iowa's Joe Crawford, Jason Snicked Venable, Jeffrey Brown, Mix Yaspidalik, Never Stop Player, Odell Abner Dracula, Phil Oschlager, Professor Frenzy, Professor Harbinger, Randy Caldwell, Relatively Geeky, Richard Field, Richard G, Ryan Daly, Secret Wars and Beyond Podcast, Sean Merrick, Schlocktopus Inc., Siskoid, to Chad Hanna, Ed Price Podcrasher, Tony Wolf, Trekker Talk, Wonder Woman Warrior for Peace Podcast, Xenozoic Xenophiles, and Zach Sally. Schlocktopus Inc. sent us a Spawn animated GIF. I always like the Spawn stuff. Yeah. Odell Abner Dracula wrote, regarding why the DC book had so many writers, referring to Batman Spawn, I feel like DC editorial must have wanted to equally distribute royalties and the exposure associated with such a high profile book. I mean, in addition to flexing on the writing of most Image offerings. Sounds reasonable.
Yeah.
He also sent us a Batman and Robin Harding Spawn drawing, which was very cute. I especially like the Spawn heart. Tony Wolf wrote, yeah, this was a very weird and maybe not very successful comic. The Batman Spawn crossover, I remember reading it and being very nonplussed. Dr. G. Nerdologist wrote, I like that Batman and Houdini Elseworld. Love the painted artwork. Read a lot like The Alienist to me. Did you ever read that Batman Houdini The Devil's Workshop, I think it was called?
No, I never. No, who wrote it?
Oh, shit. I think it was like maybe John Francis Moore or Howard Chaykin, somebody like that. I think maybe Mark Sciarello or...
Nah, it couldn't be Howard Chaykin. Lots of sex and violence.
Michelle Fife. Michelle Fife wrote on Facebook about the book. Oh, I really like Todd's work here. The heavy inking seems like a design choice rather than a shortcut. Regarding year two, Miller saw this as a chance to write Bats in peak form as opposed to Dark Knight Returns year one. Compared it to Michael Jordan at his prime. Nice props to Barr. Don't tell Englehart. And yeah, that's exactly right. I think I mentioned it in the Spawn section that I read a comic scene where they did an interview. I was wanting to find that material and I thought I had it in a Wizard or Hero Illustrated. I couldn't find it. And then I bought a comic scene while I was up in Connecticut or, no, Boston. In Boston, they had an interview with Miller, and sure enough, it is supposed to be Batman in his prime, not too early, not too late. It Goldilocks Batman.
Okay.
Way to elaborate. So that's our mail.
The world's strongest hero.
The warrior from a hidden island.
The master of super speed.
The wielder of the weapon from beyond the stars.
The champion of the seven seas.
They are the only ones standing before a world beyond the brink of collapse. Their mission? Abolish war and crime. Eliminate poverty and hunger. Clean the environment. Cure disease. Even stop death itself. They promise within a year to make the world a utopia, no matter how many lines they might need to cross.
Coming soon to the Pulp to Pixel Network, The Squadron Supreme Cast, an exploration of Mark Gruenwald's epic 1985 Squadron Supreme miniseries. A look at the heroes, the villains, the fine lines separating them, and how this miniseries continues to play an influence in mainstream superhero comics.
The time is out of joint.
The time is out of joint.
The time is out of joint.
The year is 1994, or 1944, or maybe 2994. Time is under threat, and history is falling apart.
Who will survive this crisis? And how will history be changed for those that do? Zero Hour Strikes takes you back to that DC Comics crossover and covers the entire story, issue by issue, tie-in by tie-in, as the DC Universe goes down to zero. Join Bass and Siskoid at fireandwaterpodcast.com or on iTunes. Zero Hour Strikes, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. Remember Legion.
Monthly, monthly, monthly. It's Action Film Face-Off.
Hello, I'm Jason the Weasel Skull Ulbrich, and I'd like to tell you about a podcast I do with my brother, Jared Ulbrich, the yard sale artist.
Action Film Face-Off.
Yes, thank you, Jared. Action Film Face-Off is a podcast where my brother and I, who are both military combat vets...
Jason was a Navy SEAL.
Jason was not a Navy SEAL. Jason was a military intelligence wing. But anyway, in each episode of Action Film Face-Off, we select two different action films.
Some of them have Chuck Norris.
Technically speaking, none of them have had Chuck Norris yet, but it could happen because we use a randomizer set between 1970 and modern day to select our two films. So you'll always get two films, each from a different year.
Our randomizer has spikes on it.
We use a Google random number generator, so it does not have spikes on. And we put the films into our Video Dome arena.
It also has spikes.
It does not have spikes. But we discuss the films and score them through six different rounds of criteria.
I score Bond films very high.
Okay, that's true. But anyway, by the end of the episode, we crown one of the action films the champion of Action Film Face-Off.
Next episode, Jason fights a bear.
Jason is not fighting a bear, but please give our show a listen. We're part of the Long Box Crusade network of shows.
Pat Sampson killed a man with a sword once.
I can neither confirm nor deny that statement, but you can find us on iTunes, Google Play, and most podcatchers under Long Box Crusade, or you can subscribe to just our show by searching for Action Film Face-Off.
Come see the blood fly!
And that's Action Film Face-Off. We do, indeed, invite you to come and see the blood fly.
I just said that.
This is a fan-produced, not-for-profit podcast. No copyright infringement is intended, and any use of copyrighted materials believed to be covered under fair use. If you don't agree, you can go straight to hell!